But I had one person write in telling me that my mother sounded like Enzo Amore. Enzo Amore.
Enzo Amore.
My name is Mama Monsta, and I am a certified mama and a bona fide monster, and you can't teach that. And this right here, this is my son, the Sala Monster, and he's 5'8" tall.
6 feet.
You're not 6 feet tall.
Okay, just keep going.
He's about average height, and you can't teach that. Bada boom, realest mom in the room. How are you doing?
Wait, did you just call me average?
Well, your father was 6'2", and he was like Andre the Giant compared to you.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat, delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Well, it's true. If I ever set foot in a WWE ring, Vince McMahon would probably look at me and put me in the cruiserweight division, so she's not wrong about that, but there you go. I still don't hear the similarities between Mama Monster and Enzo Amore, but to those who do, hopefully you got a kick out of that. This is episode 497 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Memorial Day weekend, Sunday, May 28th, 2017. I am a very sick Sala Monster, as you could probably hear. So if I sound terrible, if I sound different, it is because I am in the grips of a terrible cold, and my tonsils are all swollen. I can barely speak, but I'm going to soldier on, because just because I'm sick doesn't mean there isn't news to talk about this week. There's news to talk about every single week. I feel like if I let 1 week go by, everything would fall apart, so we can't have that. Plus, you know, I only realized this the other day that I think it's this week, actually. It's the end of May. This marks, I believe, 7 straight years of never missing a week of audio. And I'm proud of that, so I want to keep that going as long as I can. But this is episode 497. We are on the road to 500. Thank you, as always, for all of your support, including those who keep supporting by way of Audible. AudibleTrial.com/Sala Monster is our link. If you put that in, you can sign up for a 30-day trial of the service. You will not be billed unless you extend beyond the initial 30 days. And whether you cancel or whether you stick with it, as part of your trial, if you use our link, you get one free audiobook that you get to cash in on. And boy, there are a lot of audiobooks you guys can choose from, including The Death of WCW, Daniel Bryan's book, Chris Jericho. I can't recommend the Chris Jericho books enough. I think only the second one is on Audible. They're all great, so you can cash in on that one. Others have cashed in on non-wrestling books. But when you use our link, you're supporting the podcast and you're getting something for free. So audibletrial.com/Sala Monster is the link to use. Let me try to move in here a little bit, get a little bit closer, since my voice, it's not carrying quite as far here today. PayPal. This was a big PayPal week. You guys really killed it. You want to make a PayPal donation, you could do so at any time. On the SalaMonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. And I want to say thank you. Do a big roll call here. We'll run through the names. To John Loose Cannon Lopez, naturally. Deadpool James Herrera. Oh, my God. You could tell, right? Well, this has just been brutal, man. This whole morning has been brutal. Deadpool James Herrera, there we go. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Out of Control Cody Thomas. The Florida Freebird Brian Becerra. Bobby the Wizard Waldrop. Tori All I Do Is Win Johansson. We haven't heard from Tori in a while. We've got Damn Straight Michael Dorsey. Ryan the Dagger McTaggart. Massgrave Micah Harshaw. Lionheart Michael Paez. Judge and Jury Justin Girardi. Raymond the Mountie Medina. The Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, The Captain of Carnage, Christopher Gomez, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Joe Hand Grenade Herrera, the Chapel Hill High Flyer Kyle George, the Inglewood Warlock Sean Rue, Kelvin Bearhug Bello. Shout out, by the way, to his son Brandon, who isn't even born yet. He's due in the next few weeks. The Maniac Messiah, Kaleem Jameson, Michael Maximum Payne Palkowski, Real Rock and Roll Orion Hodge, Left Hook Luke Hyams, Renard Hawkeye Hussey, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, Capital Carnage Christian Reyes, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog, The Show Off, Corey Van Dam, good old CVD, Fat Mac, gotta talk about this guy here, Fat Mac Bubba Waterfield, who co-hosts the Beef Sticks podcast with his partner Pasty White. That's his name. Ironically, that's my name, too, that some people have given me. But it's a live wrestling podcast for the adult fan, definitely not a PG show. They talk WWE, Ring of Honor, New Japan, and a whole lot more. And also, they take time to promote local brewing companies as they sample and critique local beers. So give the Beef Sticks podcast a listen on Spreaker, iTunes, Google Play Music, or Stitcher Radio. You can check out their cloud style umbrella with all of their shows on Spreaker.com/user/cloudstyle. And finally here, Stephen Handyman Halustick, or Halustick, there you go, who wants everybody to know, check out Digital Fiasco. They are a gaming website and weekly podcast covering PlayStation, Xbox, Nintendo, and PC games with a little nerd culture thrown in there. You can check them out at digitalfiasco.wtf. I didn't even know that they had WTF extensions. That's pretty cool. So, great turnout on the donations this week. If there's one thing that makes me feel good, it's that people care enough to make a donation. So when I saw all the there was this mass flood. I think people wait until the last minute thinking that. I don't know why people do that, though. Because sometimes they miss the cutoff. So I wouldn't wait too late, you know. But it's not like it matters what order I read the names in. But there was this mass flood of donations yesterday into last night. And it was kind of hard to keep up, but it's a good problem to have. I appreciate all the support. I hope you guys are ready for the 500th show. This is only 497. I want a big 500 show. So we got to make this even bigger. And if you donate and you get a shout out on that show, you could be part of Sound Off history. Just remember that. Before we get into all of the fun stuff, unfortunately, we have some serious stuff to talk about first. I want to just say, you know, my thoughts are certainly with those who lost loved ones in the Manchester bombing. I have a lot of listeners in the UK. I've mentioned this before. I hear from you guys all the time, and it really broke my heart to see pictures of those little kids who were killed. Obviously, it wasn't just little kids, but when you see that, it just, you know, it makes you wonder about humanity, is what it does. And all because they wanted to go to a concert. You know, it was an Ariana Grande concert, and for this to happen is just horrendous. There's some real evil SOBs in this world. Just subhuman pieces of garbage. That could have easily have been a WWE event in that building. In fact, WWE had an NXT show scheduled for that very arena in Manchester on June 6th. They have since canceled the show, but they are still sending NXT talent to Manchester to visit with people affected by the tragedy. And they will be back there again for Raw and SmackDown tapings in November. But you know, at the end of the day, you can be as vigilant as you want. You can beef up security as much as possible. But all it takes is one person who's determined enough. And that is almost impossible to stop. But I also need to mention this guy's name, David Levitt. I'm sure some of you heard about this. A lot of you haven't, so I want to make sure you do. David Levitt, another piece of garbage. He is a freelance writer, or was a freelance writer. CBS, among the outlets that he had listed in his Twitter bio, that have since distanced themselves from him after he tweeted out a bunch of tasteless jokes about the bombing as it was going on. So as people were laying dead in the street, he decided to take to Twitter and say a bunch of stupid shit. And he got called out on it, and he took down the initial tweet, he said, only because people would not stop tweeting him about it. So how nice of him to take it down. Instead of leaving well enough alone, you know, the damage had already been done, he continued posting snarky bullshit all throughout the night, into the morning. He did one impressive thing, if I will give him credit, I will give him credit for this. He somehow managed to unite people from opposite ends of the political spectrum. So the far left and the far right came together in condemnation of this piece of crap. So, and that's a hard thing to do. That's a hard thing to do these days. So somehow he managed to pull that off. That's about the only talent he possesses. Comedy certainly is not one of them, even though he considers himself like a comedian or a comedy writer or whatever. Comedy is not one of his fortes. So I thought it was important to call out the garbage that comes out when stuff like that happens. You know, I don't know what goes through people's heads. I really don't. You know, I understand there's a time and a place for levity and for humor, but this was neither. And how somebody in that position could actually think to themselves, hey, you know, it would be a great idea for me to go and say these things right now as all of this is going on. And I work for all of these outlets, and I'm sure it's going to go over so well with them. The lack of judgment there is just mind-boggling to me. And when people are that stupid, they deserve to be called out on it. So there you go. I was also very sad to hear about the death of Sir Roger Moore. I was really bummed to hear about that. He would have turned 90 years old in October. Died from cancer, although his family did not say what type. My favorite James Bond, I know you've heard me say that on the show before. Some of you vehemently disagreed with me, all the Sean Connery fans out there. But he was in lots of other films too. Cannonball Run, of course. How could I forget, right? Seymour Goldfarb Jr. he played a Jewish guy who thinks he's Roger Moore. So that gives you a sense of the kind of movie that is. Really funny stuff. But he also had a part, and this has to be said, in the interest of full disclosure, he also had a part in the Spice Girls movie that came out in the late 90s. So, hey, they can't all be winners. But the role he was known for was Bond. My favorite James Bond, probably because it's the one I grew up on. You know, my mom had all the VHS tapes when I was a kid that she had bought. So I was always watching the Roger Moore James Bond movies. Man with the Golden Gun, Live and Let Die, The Spy Who Loved Me. I thought those three were the best Bond films that he did. I have a soft spot for the last one he did too. I know a lot of people don't, but A View to a Kill, I liked that film. I mean, it had Christopher Walken in it, and it had a great Duran Duran song for a title track. So to me, it's like, what's not to love? Octopussy, still the best title of a Bond film of any of the films that he did. As a kid, I didn't think anything of it. I'm like, I want to watch Octopussy, and I can only imagine how that must have sounded. But I will say this on the subject of Bond real quick here before we move on. I have seen most of the Daniel Craig Bond movies, all of them except the last one he did, which was the one that Batista was in, and I wanted to see it. I just never did. So if it's worth it for me to go watch, let me know. But I really like Daniel Craig as James Bond. And if I had to make a list of all the Bond films that I've seen, including his, and rank them by which ones I enjoyed the most, Casino Royale would be in my top three. That's how much I like that movie. I still think the opening action sequence of that movie is one of the best opening action sequences I've ever seen. I mean, I'm not going to put it up there with, you know, Saving Private Ryan. That's a whole other type of opening sequence, but really good stuff. There were a couple of people wondering if I was going to be doing another unboxing video on the YouTube channel for Pro Wrestling Crate. I would have, but apparently my crate was delivered to my doorstep over a week ago, and I never got it, which means that someone stole it. So no unboxing this month. Hopefully we'll get back to that next month. Backlash was last Sunday. If you missed it, I got a half-hour review of the show up on our YouTube channel, and the Maharaja has been good for business, although with this YouTube ad nonsense, it probably would have been good for business 6 months ago, maybe not so much now. But over 65,000 views and counting for my review, with Jinder Mahal becoming the 50th man in history to hold the WWE Championship. This was kind of a big deal, not just in India, but in Canada. Take a listen to this. This is unbelievable. It's audio from a meeting of the Canadian Parliament in Alberta this week, honoring Jinder Mahal for his championship win. This is real. This is not a joke. Here is the audio from the meeting of the Canadian Parliament.
For Calgary, Shaw.
I have three documents to table today. The first one was dated Sunday, May 21st from the Allstate Arena in Chicago, Illinois, by the WWE Network. Jinder Mahal defeats Randy Orton to become new WWE champion. Second document is from Times of India. I want to represent India and make them proud. WWE champion Jinder Mahal in reference to his WWE Backlash win. Second one, this document from the Calgary Herald. Don't hinder Jinder Mahal. He's the first Calgarian professional wrestler to win the WWE Championships in 20 years. With the subtext, it's been 20 years since Calgary last saw a WWE champion when wrestling legend Bret the Hitman Hart claimed his fourth title in 1997. I think I speak for all Albertans when I would like to congratulate this talented wrestler from Calgary on his championship win.
Wow. Hearing Jinder Mahal's name mentioned in the same breath as Bret Hart just seems wrong to me. But, you know, hey, at least Blandy Orton is no longer the champion, so that's a plus. I thought the show was good overall. I really enjoyed the tag team title match with Breezango. Owens and AJ, I thought, had the best match of the night. And the ending was newsworthy, certainly. It's going to take time for me. I speak for myself on this. It's going to take time for me to care about Jinder Mahal as WWE champion. The idea of it is still very surreal to me. It may happen, but I'm not sold. And, you know, for all these people who said, you wanted someone new, you wanted something new, and you got something new, so now you have no right to complain. The idea that Jinder Mahal, right, who debuted on television 6 years ago and has been used as a perennial jobber to the stars for basically the entire length of his career, is now considered something new, is comical to me. It is absolutely Now, it's different, but it's not new. So let's not confuse the two things, okay? Just please stop saying that. It's different. And now Jinder's going to have a chance to prove a lot of people wrong. I'm not a Jinder hater. Oh, you're hating on Jinder. You're hindering the Jinder. You hate Jinder. I don't hate Jinder. I'm Jinder neutral. That's what I am. But I cannot criticize anyone who has an issue with Jinder Mahal being a WWE champion, because you can't expect everybody to just buy into a guy who goes overnight from zero to hero. Now, don't forget, Jinder was not brought back for any reason other than to be a warm body to put other people over. Okay, that's why he came back. He was to Raw what Curt Hawkins was to SmackDown. It wasn't until his body changed that Vince McMahon did a 180 on the guy. And don't kid yourself into thinking that for any reason other than that, oh, it's India. It's because of India. Bullshit. And you know what? I guess it works for Jinder. It makes him stand out in a way that he would not have stood out 30 years ago, right? If he was in WWE in, say, let's say 1987, at a time when everybody was at least 6'3", 6'4", jacked to the gills, he would have been a footnote if he even would have gotten in the door. But today, the guys are a lot smaller, and now we have somebody who looks the way that he does. You know, I'm sure Vince McMahon had a full-on pants tent going on when he saw him, and so here we are. So now we wait for the All-American hero, John Cena, to make his triumphant return, defeat the evil foreign menace from Calgary, and win title number 17, because you know it's coming. I joked about the YouTube ad stuff before. It's no laughing matter for What Culture Pro Wrestling. They put out a statement this week announcing that they have been forced to cancel the tapings for their weekly WCPW Loaded show because with YouTube's new monetization policy, they claim they can no longer financially provide a free show to people on YouTube. So the tapings for June, July, and August have all been canceled. This does not affect their pay-per-views and some other shit. It's not like they're closing up, but I guess this weekly show is no longer feasible for them to do. They claim they made $44 on an Alberto El Patron Rey Mysterio match on their channel that did over 1.1 million views. So if you are a wrestling content creator on YouTube, with the number of subs that they have, and they have over a million subscribers, and you rely on your ad revenue, if a video that does over a million views doesn't even net you $50, you can imagine the little guys, right? The little guys don't stand a chance. Those are the people I feel sorry for, but we'll see. I mean, look, there's still a chance that things can change. I know people have been voicing their opinions. There's some kind of petition going around. Those change.org petitions are such a joke. I don't even pay them any attention, but people are trying to make noise, and we'll see if YouTube listens. Here's some good news that I am happy to report. Sean Waltman had the charges against him dropped this week by the state of California due to insufficient evidence. Waltman had already taken and passed a lie detector test, and after those pills they caught him with a few weeks ago at LAX were tested, which they claim were meth, they turned out not to be meth. Or methamphetamine, or whatever they tested them for. They were not, like, hard narcotics of any kind. They were, in fact, pills that had been prescribed to him for a yeast infection, which I'm sure he's so happy that everybody knows now, you know? I guess he felt he had to just come out and tell the truth about everything, which is great. But if you have a yeast infection, probably not the sort of thing you want the entire world to know. But anyway, that's great news. The charges were dropped, not that he has a yeast infection, so I was very happy to hear that. Monday Night Raw. Oh, I've got a lot to say about this show. And not specifically the show for Monday, just Raw in general. Raw was live from Grand Rapids, Michigan last Monday. Over 1,700 of you voted in our Twitter poll. 39% thumbs up, 61% thumbs down. The big story here, as it pertains to Raw, is that the lows keep getting lower. What did I say a few weeks ago, right? It's not so much the week-to-week number. Those will go up and down. They'll fluctuate. Pay attention to the lows, because the lows keep getting lower. Raw was down to 2.6 million viewers this week, their lowest audience in over two decades. Two decades. And tomorrow is Memorial Day, so I don't expect it to be much better. But, you know, I was just talking to Noah Mark. I hadn't talked to him in a while, so we were talking a couple of weeks ago, this was, about this very subject, about Raw. And he was like, oh, I noticed you don't live tweet during the show as much when it's on. And it's true. I have the show on as background noise on most weeks now. Either that or I hit the gym to go do cardio. Okay, let me illustrate for you. This is actually a great illustration of how long this damn show is, okay? So here's a typical Monday night for me. I don't get home from work until 7, 7.30 if there's no traffic coming home from the city, okay? So figure by 7.30 I'm home. Usually, I'll eat something real quick. And, you know, I'll head to the gym to get 60 minutes or 90 minutes of cardio in. Okay, as you could probably tell if you look at me, I haven't exactly been doing much in the way of lifting, right? Lifting the toilet seat up and down. That's about the extent of my lifting lately. But, you know, I get home. Now it's around 10:15 when I get back home. I jump in the shower. By the time I get out, the show is still on. Not only is it still on, there's at least half an hour left. And oh, I love this. I especially love this. When, if let's say I'm not watching, right? I'm just like, you know what? I already missed most of it. I'm just going to watch it later or on the DVR or whatever. So I'm not watching. I still try to get a Twitter poll up every week so you guys can vote, right? So I try to time it. Okay, the show goes to 11:05, 11:06, whatever. And I put the poll up. And then I'll start getting tweets sometimes saying, wait, it's not over yet. It's not over. It's not over. It's 10 after 11. Do you really need an overrun for a 3-hour show? Is that really necessary? And I think what they should find troubling is the thought that I would decide to go anywhere or do anything other than watch Raw on Mondays, because to me, as one of the diehards, that used to be a foreign concept to me, right? I would never do that up until about 6 months ago. Before that, it's like, hey, it's Monday night, it's Raw, gotta watch Raw, right? Now, it's like, whatever happens, happens. Even with YouTube and DVR and all that kind of stuff, you know, I guess part of it is the live nature of the show. Part of it is wanting to kind of tweet and communicate with others during the show. And sometimes also because, you know, there's so much wrestling in the week and this show alone is so long, you know, Raw that is, that when I get to do the podcast, I sometimes have to refer back to my tweets to remind me of some of the things that happened because, you know, unless you do that, it's impossible to remember every single thing that's happened on that show. But I think the live nature of it was a big part of why I always felt like, all right, I really got to watch this show. Plus, you know, if I want to watch most or all of the show, it's 3 hours, right? So I'd rather just watch it on a Monday and not have to carve out 2.5 hours or 3 hours on a different night to go back and watch it. But again, 6 months ago, I don't know what it was. Something clicked, something changed, and the show, it became something that had been a priority that really wasn't much of a priority to me anymore. And that should concern them, because I was always lumped into the same category with the diehards, right? I'm not like a fly-by-night bandwagon casual fan, obviously. I'm like a lot of you guys listening right now. You wouldn't be listening to a wrestling podcast if you weren't a diehard wrestling fan. Whether you're a WWE fan or an Impact fan or a New Japan fan, you love wrestling. Some wrestling you hate, but you love wrestling. That's why you're listening to a show like this. So we're all kind of in the same boat. And I can't even imagine now sitting in front of the television doing nothing but watching this show for 3 hours straight the way that I used to. I just can't even fathom that. And I never thought that that would be me. You know, creature of habit, you know? I've watched this show a certain way for so long that I couldn't imagine, you know, watching it in any other way, but they managed to beat it out of me. A lot of you guys were already doing that, so I know I'm late to the game here. You guys have been browbeating me for years. Dude, just watch the clips on YouTube. Don't watch the whole show. It's like, no, I have to. So you guys were way ahead of me on that. But I can't imagine going back to the way things were. Now, obviously, I do go back. I watch most of the show because I have to be able to follow along with everything that's happening leading into the pay-per-views and whatnot. And an awful lot of you now rely on me and this show to keep up with what goes on Raw because you guys, in some cases, have just completely checked out. So you're still kind of interested in what's going on, but you don't even watch. I can't tell you how many messages tweets when I was tweeting about it this week. How many of you said, dude, I don't even watch it anymore. But we should be asking the question, how did it get to this point? Where did it go wrong that longtime fans like me can't even take it anymore? What happened? What happened that the lows keep getting lower for this TV show? And how can they fix it? Because most weeks, you know, I still enjoy SmackDown. I still enjoy NXT. I absolutely adore those TakeOver shows. I've enjoyed a lot of the network specials they've done. The Cruiserweight Classic may have been the best series of any kind that company has ever produced. The UK tournament was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to hearing Jim Ross calling the Mae Young Classic this summer. That's the official name for the women's tournament that they're doing. Jim Ross and Lita are rumored to be the announced team for that one. Lita is a rumor at this point. JR is confirmed for it, though. My point is, there's a lot to like about WWE right now. It's not all bad. But the Raw problem is very real, and it's getting worse. This is their flagship show. This is the show I grew up on. This is a show that at one time was doing 7 or 8 million viewers a week with overruns of a 9 or a 10 rating. Even if you consider cord cutting and changes in technology, look at the drop. The drop should not be that dramatic. And by the way, they were doing a 9 and a 10 rating for that overrun after 11 o'clock on a work night. So I love it when people now are like, well, you know, the third hour of the show drops because kids have to go to school and people have to go to work. As though Raw didn't air from 9 to 11 20 years ago. Are you kidding me? When they were doing those super duper ratings. And believe me, you had just as many, if not more, kids watching what was not really a PG-friendly product back then than you do even now. Didn't seem to matter back then that it was a school night when they were up watching at 11 o'clock, so I don't want to hear that bullshit. But think about that. That's what this show was doing at one point. How did we go from must-see and anything can happen to who cares and I know exactly what's going to happen? The formula is the same every single week. There just is nothing to get excited about. I'll be honest with you, I wasn't expecting the response that I got when I tweeted all of this out on Tuesday after the rating came out. Every single tweet, there wasn't one person, not one, who came to WWE's defense. Every single tweet, people gave their own story about why they either don't watch anymore or they barely pay attention. It was scary. It was really scary. Tweet after tweet, there was a writer for the website Bloody Disgusting who replied back to me and said the same thing. It's been so boring, he said, and repetitive lately that he finds himself tuning out when he would never do that before. This is a problem. You cannot just chalk this up to, well, cord cutting or the ratings don't matter anymore, right? That's the great thing that Vince, I think, once said in one of those investor calls. Well, you know, they're not as important. Yeah, we'll find out about that. In about 2 years or so, when their TV contract comes up, we'll find out how important those ratings are. But beyond ratings, I mean, forget the ratings for a second. That's really a WWE problem to worry about. I mean, I talk about the ratings because I find that stuff interesting because I'm a nerd. But at the end of the day, I just want it to be a fun show. And so they've got to come up with a way to either just change the way they do things. Because I don't think it has so much to do with the talent. They have a lot of talented guys, big names, even though some of them don't show up for months at a time. I don't know that the roster is really the issue. I think it's the show. I think it's just how they present it, whether it's something right down to the, you know, commercial breaks during main events, which you never had. I will give the devil his due, Mr. Russo over there, because that was one thing you never had, or very rarely. Did you go into a main event, a hot main event, and have one, two, three different commercial breaks? That has more to do with just how you space those things out. I understand commercial breaks, as an example, are a necessary evil. I'm not saying, well, just get rid of commercial breaks. Plus, it's USA that sells that time. It's not even WWE. But, you know, is there no way to structure things a little bit? It's almost like they're afraid to break out of their own cocoon. They're getting in their own way. It's as though they're just so set with their formula and their formulaic way of doing things that either they're afraid or they're too stubborn to change. I don't know what it is, but something has to change. And I'm sure everybody has their own thoughts on what that is. I'd love to hear it, but it's a problem. There's no doubt about it. It's definitely a problem. Now, 205 Live, meanwhile, continues its own descent into irrelevance. Yet again, the show failed to crack the top 20, not top 10, top 20 most watched shows for the week on the WWE Network. Halloween Havoc 1998 cracked the top 20 this week, but not 205 Live. This is according to the Wrestling Observer. They have each week the ranking of the top 10 or so most watched shows on the network. A WCW pay-per-view, a promotion that has not even been alive in over 15 years. And ironically, the promotion that popularized the word cruiserweight in this country on a national level, outperformed 205 Live. Which is too bad, because I had heard from you guys, oh, Brian Kendrick and Akira Tozawa had this great street fight, and I actually went back and I watched it, and it was really good. It was a really good match. I saw Tozawa's senton off the top through the table, which was incredible. It's too bad more people saw Billy Kidman beat Disco Inferno. They continued the build to the Fatal 5-Way at Extreme Rules with Bray Wyatt and Samoa Joe beating two-thirds of the Shield, Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns went for the Superman punch to Joe. Joe moved. Reigns ran into Rollins. He didn't punch him. He collided with him, but he did not punch him. But Rollins yelled at him anyway, and Wyatt yanked Roman out of the ring, gave him a Sister Abigail. Joe put Rollins in the clutch, and he choked him out for the submission. Are we allowed to say that? Can we say the word choked? He choked him out. I guess in WWE lingo, it would be he put him to sleep. Every time they say that, I get this vision. Like, he put him to sleep. I get this vision in my head of Joe, like, tucking Seth under the covers and reading him a bedtime story. He choked the fucker out. That's what he did. Not a bad match. It built dissension between Rollins and Reigns heading into their singles match tomorrow night. Kurt Angle also made a triple threat for tomorrow night with Samoa Joe, Bray Wyatt, and Finn Balor. So those are some interesting matches, and I like the fact that they actually announced some matches ahead of time, which they don't always do, so that was good. Speaking of Balor, he beat Karl Anderson. Pretty good little match. Leave it to WWE, though, instead of putting these guys together, to put them in the ring against each other. Before the match, Paul Heyman emerged from his hibernation to confront Balor. He put him over as the best wrestler in WWE today. So apparently Paul Heyman thought he was on SmackDown talking to AJ Styles. Balor told Heyman to deliver a message to his client. He's going to win the Fatal 5-Way, and he's going to beat Brock Lesnar to win back the Universal Championship. Heyman said that of the five possibilities, the match that he was most intrigued by was Balor against Lesnar. And that I would agree with. I would agree with that. I think Joe and Lesnar would be a lot of fun, no doubt, but I do find the idea of Balor against Brock intriguing precisely because of the size difference. And they sure did try to make you think that Balor was the one who was going to be getting the beast next. I hope he does. I hope he does. I would like to see Balor against Brock at Fireballs in July. Although the idea that Braun Strowman might come back on that show to possibly screw Roman Reigns over, you screw him out of the championship. One of the people, I think, in the Facebook group floated that this week. I read that. I hadn't thought about that, and I read that. I'm like, oh, God, that actually makes sense. I could see them doing that. But I really don't want to see that. That's the problem. We already saw that finish. Here's my issue with that. So if the whole thing with Strowman, you know, it's going to be 6 months, if that was all BS and he's going to be back by, let's say, that July pay-per-view, right? He comes out, he makes an appearance. Yeah, I mean, in a way, it would make sense for him to screw Roman out of the championship so you could do Reigns and Lesnar and not, you know, give them a full match with a decisive finish and save that if you want for WrestleMania. They could do that. But my issue with it is we already saw the exact same finish this year. Earlier this year at the Royal Rumble, Braun Strowman came out. He screwed Roman Reigns out of the Universal title at the Royal Rumble in his match with Kevin Owens. So they would be recycling the exact same finish with almost all of the same parties. That's just stupid, right? And not very creative. Hopefully it's Balor. Balor wins the 5-way. He gets Brock on the July pay-per-view. Rollins and Joe can have their blow-off match on that show. I think it would be great if Strowman was able to make it back in time for that pay-per-view so that he and Roman could do their rubber match on that show. I don't know, that may be a little ambitious. I don't know that Strowman will be back in time for a match on that show, but that would be great if he was. Strowman then could beat Roman, and Bray Wyatt can cost Balor the championship against Brock. So that sets up Strowman and Brock for the title at SummerSlam, and then a singles match between Balor and Bray, which seemed to be the direction they were going in before Strowman got hurt, and they decided to just dump everybody into the same 5-way match. So I could see things going that way as well. But to do, you know, just to have Roman win the 5-way, and then have Strowman do the run-in on that show, again, we saw that at the Rumble, so I hope that's not what they have in mind. Matt Hardy beat Sheamus, which meant the Hardys got to pick the stipulation for their match against Sheamus and Cesaro at Extreme Rules. Oh, man, I'm struggling here. I don't know if this voice is going to hold for another 90 minutes, guys. Anyway, they chose a steel cage match. They're going to have a steel cage match for the tag team titles at the next pay-per-view. The Drifter made his in-ring Raw debut against Dean Ambrose. He beat Dean Ambrose by DQ after Miz ran in and attacked the Drifter. He attacked Elias Sampson, but he was very strategic in doing that because he wanted to give Sampson the win over Ambrose to show Ambrose that at the pay-per-view, if he gets DQ'd, he will lose his Intercontinental Championship because the title can change hands on a DQ. Enzo Amore was attacked backstage by a mystery assailant. When is Enzo not getting attacked by someone would be a better question rather than who did it. The guy is so obnoxious, I'm surprised they haven't found him in a dumpster somewhere. Cass found him. He was furious. He demanded to find out who was responsible for this. And many of you instantly tweeted me saying, oh, it must be Cass. It must be Cass who did it. And at first, I had no idea what you were talking about because I wasn't watching it live. But then I kind of got the gist of it. And I thought the same thing. I was thinking the same thing, too, until some eagle-eyed observers noticed the Revival walking in the background during a segment later on with Charlie Caruso. She was backstage interviewing someone, I don't remember. And you could see, if you watch closely, you could see the Revival in the background. They were walking. They were going from one room to another. I'm sure that was done on purpose. They had a swagger in their step, unless they walk around like a couple of douchebags in real life, too. I guess that's possible. But they are due back any week now. I believe Dash Wilder's jaw should be just about fully healed by now. It probably would be too soon to do a Cass and Enzo split because they just broke up another babyface tag team and they had Goldust go heel on R-Truth. So to do the same exact thing here with these guys, probably too soon to do that. But I do think it's coming in the next few months. I think they're going to split Cass and Enzo up. I don't know that they're ever going to hold the tag team titles. They never did in NXT. They can't seem to make it happen here on the main roster so far. And you gotta know that they see big things in the future for Cass. So I think it's just a matter of when and not if. Speaking of Goldust, he may have been the best part of this entire show. This probably was the thing I enjoyed the most. We got an old school Goldust vignette with his music playing in the background and the whole nine yards. He said he's back in the director's chair and now he controls when and where his film will end. If we get some more classic Goldust, like I'm not talking freaky ball gag Goldust from the Attitude Era, but like classic Goldust from 1996, that could be a lot of fun. The cool part is that with the makeup on, he looks exactly the same. I mean, the wig was missing. But aside from the wig, you can't even tell that he's aged. That's the beauty of working in face paint, right? I'd say if you're a rookie first coming into the wrestling business, wear face paint. Because you could wrestle for the next 30 years and have a very good career for yourself and not look like you've aged a day. So anyway, that's really all you need to know about Raw. I've covered all the important stuff. I have condensed a three-hour show into 10 minutes here. I wish they could do the same. SmackDown Live from Tuesday, the poll, over 1,700 votes, just like Raw. 78% thumbs up, 22% thumbs down, very much not like the rating that you guys gave Raw. According to a report from ProWrestlingSheet.com, WWE will likely announce in the next few weeks the first ever women's Money in the Bank match for the Money in the Bank pay-per-view coming up on June 18th. Which is, ironically, the same weekend as Sound Off 500. On TV this week, Shane McMahon announced a fatal five-way for SmackDown this Tuesday. What is with all of these multiple-person matches on these shows? My God, that's going to be two fatal five-ways in less than a week that we have coming up. We have one on Tuesday, and we have one next Sunday. The winner of that match will meet Naomi for the SmackDown Women's Championship at Money in the Bank. I would presume, they haven't announced this, but I would presume then that the other women would compete in the Money in the Bank match itself for the women. It's interesting to note that in none of these reports that I've seen about this, it has not been explicitly said that it's a Money in the Bank ladder match, only that they are going to do a women's Money in the Bank match. So it could be a regular match, it could be a completely different stipulation, which I almost think it would be you'd be better off doing, because if you remember, back on Sound Off 481 in February, I was asked a mailbag question about WWE possibly doing an all-women's Royal Rumble match and an all-women's Money in the Bank match, what my thoughts were on that and my fear. And I think it's fine. I think it makes sense to do both those things. But my fear with the Money in the Bank match is that if it's a ladder match, you're dealing with women who have no experience wrestling in ladder matches or climbing ladders, right? Even now. If they're going to do that, and let's say they've had this thought in their mind for a while, you would think that at some point we'd see like a singles ladder match involving two women, nothing like that. We've not seen anything like that. And my biggest fear with this whole concept of doing a women's Money in the Bank ladder match is that they're going to kill themselves. Someone is going to get hurt. So if it is a ladder match, I hope they lower that briefcase down real low. Because otherwise, I think they're just asking for trouble. The six men in this year's Men's Money in the Bank ladder match will be AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, which means we may get our first taste of Styles against Nakamura in a WWE ring, Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens, Baron Corbin, and Dolph Ziggler, the only one of the six who's actually won a Money in the Bank match before. Feels like a lifetime ago. Corbin and Zayn had a rematch from Backlash here on this show with Sami rolling him up in about 30 seconds. This was really more of an angle than a match. Corbin destroyed him when it was over, although you would think the production team would see this and would shoot it from a different angle, but they didn't. Corbin was giving these horrendous-looking forearms to Sami's head. He had his head propped up against the barricade. He starts raining blows, raining forearms down upon him. The only problem is he was forearming the barricade. It looked so bad. Like, not only did they shoot this thing straight up, like, dead on so you could see, they replayed it. It was like, come on, man. Come on, you could do better than that. Anyway, Sami ended up leaving the building on a stretcher. If he's out of Money in the Bank, and I'm not saying he will be, but if he was out of Money in the Bank, they could replace him with Rusev. We still haven't seen Rusev back yet. Jinder Mahal had a Punjabi celebration for his championship win at Backlash. This was actually very well done. I enjoyed the presentation. It kind of reminded me of that Day of the Dead ceremony they did when they had the first Grave Consequences match on Lucha Underground. Very nice presentation. And then Jinder spoke. He sounded like he was losing his voice. You think a 5-minute promo is tough? Try doing a 2-hour podcast like that, buddy. 1.3 billion people, he said, are celebrating with me in India right now. Yeah, it's funny. That's actually a lot less impressive when you read on Wikipedia that out of those 1.3 billion people, only 30 million actually speak Punjab. They gave him this big pyro celebration at the end of the segment. A lot of what he said was just boilerplate BS that you've heard him say over the last few weeks. Nothing special about the promo, but the presentation I thought was very well done. Randy Orton will get his rematch at Money in the Bank. And you know what? He jobbed to Mark Henry. 2 straight pay-per-views won, so hey, why not Jinder Mahal? The Usos and Breezango match was a lot of fun. They had a rematch here on this show. The way they got there, I thought, was dumb. Dumb, 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 dumb. They do not one, but two flash pins. Two fluky roll-up finishes here, with Breeze pinning Jey Uso, Fandango pinning Jimmy Uso. That's how they got themselves the rematch for the tag titles. Second one went a little bit longer than the first, but the point is, they did this on the same show where they just had Sami Zayn roll up Baron Corbin. Same finish in 30 seconds. It's like, do they not like look at this on a sheet of paper before they do it and say, huh, maybe we ought to change things up a little bit. So that was dumb. But I guess that was their creative way to get to the rematch, to do the same stupid finish 3 times on one show. But the tag team title match was a lot of fun. I thought they would do the switch. They had me convinced. I really did. I really thought, okay, they didn't do it the night before, or 2 nights earlier, because they wanted to save it for TV, and people were into it. They were into the near falls and everything. But they couldn't do it. The Usos retain. I would guess New Day now is going to come back and be their next program, and Breezango will go the way that Slater and Rhino did. You know, Slater and Rhino got hot for a while. They even had vignettes for them, just like they've started having vignettes, the fashion files and everything for Breeze and Fandango. Slater and Rhino, at least, had a run with the SmackDown Tag Team belts, and then after a while, they faded back into irrelevance. And I fear that we're about to see the same thing happen here. I'm not really sure how you keep the momentum they seem to have going if they're not in the tag team title picture. They've now lost 2 championship matches in a row. They don't deserve another rematch. So I'm not really sure where they go from here. And in the main event, we got to see AJ Styles and Nakamura team up for the very first time, beating Kevin Owens and Dolph Ziggler when Nakamura pinned Owens with the Kinshasa. We got a little bit of a stare down of sorts going on at the end of the show with Styles and Nakamura. I would say it's got to be SummerSlam or WrestleMania for that match. I personally would save it for WrestleMania next year.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week was taped in Chicago before TakeOver went on the air. So we got a lot of very awkward stand-ups with the announcers talking in vague generalities about how great and historic TakeOver was, even though it didn't actually happen yet. Aleister Black pinned Curt Hawkins with the Black Mass Kick. Another very short Aleister Black match. Patrick Clark debuted as the Velveteen Dream and beat Robert Anthony with a flying elbow off the top rope. Oh no, another flying elbow. Somebody better let Triple H know. Better find a new move, bud. There were so many video packages on this show, I kind of tuned most of it out. I mean, this is what always happens on these post-takeover shows. It's just the nature of the taping schedule at Full Sail. I think they really need to either air the show live on Wednesdays or tape one episode per week instead of taping three or four episodes at once. They've got to do one of those two things, I think, because it just makes these post-takeover shows such a bore to watch. Main event was Drew McIntyre against Wesley Blake. McIntyre got the win with his running kick. Not really a whole lot to it. I mean, it's a Wesley Blake match, so what do you expect? Quick update on Tommaso Ciampa. Coming out of the big turn with him and Gargano at the end of TakeOver. He apparently wrestled the tag team ladder match with an injured ankle last weekend. He said he was ready to go, but the ankle was hurt. But he is dealing with a major injury, and it has nothing to do with the ankle. Apparently, he suffered a different injury in that match, one that is going to require surgery, and it is going to keep him out for a while. Anytime I read reports and it says, so-and-so is on their way to Birmingham, I say to myself, uh-oh. That's at least, what, 4 to 6 months right there? They haven't really specified yet. We don't know what the injury is. We don't know how long he's going to be out for, what kind of surgery it is. But that doesn't sound good. And the timing for him could not be any worse. I'm not sure what the injury is. I know he did tweak his ankle a few days at that live event a few days before TakeOver. And how bad that injury is, I don't know. I take it that that is not anything significant. But he shoots this hot angle, this big turn at the end of the show with Johnny Gargano, and Ciampa may not even make it to Brooklyn in August. That's like the next really big TakeOver show is SummerSlam weekend. And if this injury is as bad as it sounds, he may not even be there. So that really sucks. And now it is time to say something nice about Impact.
Say something nice about Impact.
EC3, Magnus, and James Storm had a triple threat number one contenders match for a shot at the Impact World title at Slammiversary. Really good main event. I really enjoyed the match. Storm hit the last call super kick on Magnus, then EC3 shoved Storm out of the ring from behind. He stole the pin, and so EC3 is the new number one contender. If there's one match on the show to check out, that would be the one to watch. I did see the Scott Steiner return during that segment with Josh Matthews and Joseph Park. I thought it was really sad, partly because of how shockingly little of a reaction that Steiner got when he walked out there. I mean, it was like people didn't know who he was. Now look, there might be some Impact fans who, you know, are going to be like, well, you know, you didn't have any issue with WWE bringing back Goldberg, and now all of a sudden you have an issue with Scott Steiner. There's a big difference between Goldberg and Scott Steiner. WWE bringing Goldberg back, Goldberg still looked the part. He still looked the part. He got a monster reaction when he came back. Even before he came back, part of the reason he even came back in the first place was because at SummerSlam and these other shows, people were chanting Goldberg's name. They weren't chanting Scott Steiner's name. They weren't chanting Sting's name or anyone else. They were chanting for Goldberg. So they brought him back. He looked like the Goldberg of old. He looked like he could still go. And he ended up making the company a ton of money. This will not make Impact a dime. It doesn't make Impact, even under new management, look no different than the Impact of old. So I thought this segment went over like a fart in a crowded elevator. So maybe I guess we might have to rebrand this segment, say something kind of lukewarm about Impact. Because while I enjoyed the main event, that segment, not so much.
Say something kind of nice about Impact.
Fans in the UK didn't even get to see the segment because of a little snafu on the part of Spike UK. They aired the wrong episode of Impact. They somehow aired the episode from the week before. And I guess their plan now is to air this past week's show as part of a doubleheader with next week's show, this Friday, June 2nd. Didn't this happen once before? Like, I vaguely remember there being another time where TNA's network, whether it was here, whether I think it was either Pop TV or maybe it was in the UK, aired the wrong episode of Impact. How does that even happen? How does that even happen? The war of words between the Hardys and Anthem is getting uglier by the week. This week, Ed Nordholm, the Owl Master himself, affectionately dubbed No Cred Ed by Rebbe Hardy, released logs of what he claims are Anthem's communications or attempts at communications with the Hardys over the last couple of months to try to work out some sort of a settlement over the rights to the Broken Universe. And he included text messages, he included emails, including an email chain that Nordholm himself sent to someone at WWE, which he claims proves that WWE has expressed no interest whatsoever in using the Broken gimmick or getting involved to try to buy the rights to the gimmick. WWE is not interested in it, he claims. He also released excerpts from Matt Hardy's TNA contract, highlighting the clauses that would seem to back up Anthem's claim that all of the Broken Universe stuff, since it was conceived of during the time in which Matt was under contract to TNA, and because it aired on TNA television, it is therefore TNA's property. And since TNA was bought by Anthem, it's now Anthem's property. Now, if in fact, the contract that Matt signed is the one that he released some excerpts from, unless Matt can prove in a court of law that the contract was violated and was thereby nullified in some way, it would seem that Matt probably has an uphill battle here. That being said, I have to say this. This WWE email that Ed Nordholm released, with the name of the person at Titan Tower redacted, of course, proves absolutely nothing other than the fact that WWE has no interest in getting involved legally or paying Anthem some huge sum for the rights to the gimmick or working out some kind of a deal where they'd have to pay Anthem in perpetuity or something for however long they use the gimmick for. That's what I got out of it. Nowhere in there does this mystery person at WWE say that WWE has no interest in the Broken gimmick. Of course they do. Matt's already doing the gimmick halfway on TV each week. You don't think they would want to make money off that shit? You don't think they want to market that shit? You don't think they want to make Broken Matt shirts and shirts that say delete, delete, delete and obsolete? Him saying, oh, this email proves they have no interest in getting involved or buying the gimmick, it proves absolutely nothing. If WWE could use the gimmick tomorrow, they would do it in a heartbeat. They're just not going to pay Anthem some sort of royalty for doing so. That's ridiculous. And you know what? I don't blame them for not wanting to do that. Now, for their part, and by their I mean the Hardys, and by the Hardys I mean Rebbe, she claims that it's just the opposite of what Nordholm would have us believe, that it's Anthem and their lawyers who have avoided the Hardys. The Hardys have been trying to communicate with them, and they just can't get a hold of them. They disappear. They vanish. She said TNA made a literal sales pitch to WWE for the Broken gimmick, and WWE's response was basically, LOL, no thanks. She claims Anthem is mad because WWE did not go for their blatant attempt at a money grab. She says it's all going to come out in court. She claims Anthem broke confidentiality by releasing portions of Matt's contract and that it was not even the final version, the most recent version of the actual contract. And then she said that they had phone calls. She said, you know, they're releasing emails and stuff. Well, I have phone calls. And she threatened to release them, but she has yet to release anything. If I'm her, if she really feels that they've got Anthem dead to rights on this issue, there's some evidence and proof that we haven't been, we're not privy to, we haven't heard, we haven't seen, I think it would be in her best interest to just not release anything. I would do everything by the book from here on out, stick it to them in court. Lay out all the evidence there and let the court decide who's right and who's wrong. It all comes down to the contract. But we don't know what type of, we haven't seen the rest of the contract, number one. But we also don't know what type of offenses Rebbe claims Anthem is guilty of. She's claiming that they breached this and they breached that. Yeah, they mentioned putting her father, Senor Benjamin, on television as a character without paying him, without any sort of written contract or permission to air footage of him on their show. You know, other than that, we just don't know how else did TNA breach its deal with Matt Hardy. Rebbe hasn't said yet. And as much as I would love to know, she would be best suited, I would think, to just air it out in court and not on Twitter. But this whole thing is a mess. We found out this week that Billy Corgan, yeah, we haven't heard his name mentioned in this in a while. Billy Corgan was brought in to try to mediate this whole mess between the two sides. The same Billy Corgan who had his own lawsuit against TNA was brought in to try to mediate things between Anthem and the Hardys, and clearly Billy Corgan is not as good of a mediator as he is a musician. So now it goes to the courts. Really stupid move, though, I think, by Anthem, if they did break some sort of confidentiality by releasing parts of that contract. You know, I understand that everyone's been piling on and they just want to defend themselves, but I think that could be a move that comes back to bite them on the ass. And peddling this idea that WWE has no interest in the gimmick is just a flat-out lie. I don't believe that for a second. Lucha Underground is back this Wednesday. I'm very excited. Got Pentagon Dark, the Monster Matanza, Katrina. Oh, Katrina. Hey, you know, I wonder if Famous B's phone number still works. Remember that whole gimmick? Supposedly, if you call that number, 423-GET-FAME, you get a recording and then you can leave a message. I never tried it, so I don't know. But, you know what? Let's try it right now. What the hell? Let's try it right now on the air. Let's get famous. Here we go. I'm going to just bring up the dialer here. And we are going to dial 423-GET-FAME. Here we go.
This is Famous B. How may I get you fame today?
Wait, is this Famous B?
This is Famous B from the commercials. How may I get you fame today?
Oh my goodness, it is Famous B from Lucha Underground. I may be the only person who's ever called 423-GET-FAME and actually gotten you on the phone.
Well, you know, I talk to plenty of people and I get people fame all the time. You're not the only person. Masquerita Sagrada has called, and well, we see how that has happened. The great Dr. Wagner Jr. has called. He's on the rise to fame in Lucha Underground, and I'm just waiting for that day that Tejano calls me up.
That's right, former AAA mega champion Tejano.
That's right, a real thoroughbred that guy is.
Well, this Wednesday is the mid-season premiere of Lucha Underground, the second half of Season 3 on El Rey Network. The last show aired way back on January the 11th. So my question to you is, how have you been spending your time off? Have you picked up any new clients?
I've been spending my time off getting fame myself and getting others fame. I've been spending my time in Mexico doing fantastic Lucha Libre shows, making sure I stay sharp, making sure I stay crisp, always working and perfecting my game, always working on my lucha, and just doing a lot of other things as well in the television world. So, you know, everything is looking up. Everything's on the up and up, and Lucha Underground is coming back at you this Wednesday, like you mentioned. So I'm excited. I know the world is excited. Everybody has been waiting for our return, and we're back, baby.
And beautiful Brenda, how's she doing?
Oh, she's doing fantastic. She is doing beautiful, absolutely beautiful, as usual. We were actually just at East LA Comic Con representing Lucha Underground and signing thousands upon thousands of autographs just this past weekend. So that was a great experience. Everybody in LA who attended Comic Con came out and got lovely posters of myself and the beautiful Brenda. So I will tell her that the Solo Monster gives his regards to her.
No, please do. Now, you're one of the Lucha Underground originals.
Correct.
Not sure how many people are aware of this, but you were in the very first match ever held inside the temple. It was a dark match, I believe, against Bale. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. The very first match in Lucha Underground history. Match one, win one. I was the first luchador to walk down the stairs of the temple, compete in the first match, and win the very first match in Lucha Underground history. So that's something that I hold near and dear, and nobody can take that rare Famous B Lucha Underground fact away from me.
Now, is this the same Bale who had his face eaten off by Matanza?
This is the same Bale, unfortunately. Rest in peace. My brother Bale, I told him not to go around messing with them monsters, but he didn't want to listen. So we see what happened to him because of it.
Well, better him than you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. See, I'm a little bit smarter than that. You know, I have certain instincts, you know, certain instincts that kind of tell you when to run the opposite direction, if you know what I mean.
Now, let's take a step back for a second. How did you get your start in the business?
I got my start in the business actually from a flyer for a wrestling academy in Los Angeles, California, called the Santino Brothers Wrestling Academy, which is directed, and the head trainer there is Joey Chaos of XPW. So I was trained by Joey Chaos, Supreme, and, you know, all the guys from XPW. So that's pretty much how I got my start. They just opened the school, actually, and I came about maybe 3 months later. And, you know, I got the flyer and I thought about it and, you know, it sat around the house for a while and I would pick it up, look at it and move it to a certain spot of the house until I finally said, you know what, let me see what's going on, because I'm a lifelong wrestling fan from the time I can remember what a television was. I remember watching like Hillbilly Jim and those guys back in the day, you know, mid-80s to late-80s. I'm a mid-80s baby myself. And, you know, from the time I can remember what a television was, I was always into professional wrestling. I loved Macho Man, Hogan, Warrior, and all, you know, all those guys that were larger than life. And then, of course, you know, I would evolve as I got older to, you know, to the Bret Harts and the Shawn Michaels and Mr. Perfects, the workhorses, and things of that nature. So when I got this flyer, I didn't know that you can go to an actual school and academy. So I finally just said, you know what, let me give it a try. I dialed the number, picked it up. I went to the school, met with my trainers, and, you know, just never looked back. It was one of those things where I was a natural at it. And I made the declaration that this is what I wanted to do. And 8 years later, I'm still going full force and not looking back.
It's funny you mentioned that whole mid-80s period. I mean, I grew up around the same time probably as you did, so I was a fan of all the same guys you were.
Right.
And when I think of the Famous B character, it really reminds me a lot of those old school managers. I mean, I kind of see a little bit of the old, like, Bobby Heenan and Jimmy Hart in what you're doing on Lucha Underground. Is that a conscious thing? I mean, do you model it after anybody from the past?
You know what's funny is a lot of people tell me that, but I actually don't, to be honest with you. What it is just I take what's given, and what you see is me having fun with what's given. And everything that you see is natural. And, you know, a lot of the things that actually has caught on film with my character is very organic. The Get My Shoe, that was organic. I hit Masquerita so hard with my shoe that it actually bounced up and out the ring. And that was just my natural reaction, you know, just, you know, working with the beautiful Brenda. Is also a pleasure too, because she hits some very organic lines as well, and we play off each other very well. So what you see in my character is just a result of me just having fun with what's giving and taking it to another level in my terms and my mind, or what I see fit for what's given. And, you know, what you see is what comes out of the mind of me and Brenda having fun with our characters.
The name Famous B, where did it come from? Were you always Famous B, or did you start out as something else?
Well, I've always been Famous B. It's one of the names I came up with just during the course of my training before I had my debut professional wrestling match. And it just stemmed from the idea that I knew I would be famous at something. It was just professional wrestling is what you know, culminated to be what my career, what my life passion and dreams would be, and now I'm doing it. I could have been an actor, I could have been a movie star, I could have been a rapper, I could have been a professional basketball player. I do it all. So Famous B is what the name I came up with in professional wrestling when I started training.
Now, your first few appearances on Lucha Underground were not overly successful. You had your arm broken by Pentagon Jr. In fact, were you the first person? I mean, I think you might have been the first person to have their arm broken by Pentagon on the show.
I was. I was the first person.
Well, that's something to that's something to hang your hat on.
That's tragic. That's what it is. It's tragic. Yeah, but I was the first person to pretty much kick off what would be a string of arms that became broken. And it's one of those things where the evolution of Famous B you would start to see in season two. In fact, I was actually cast as a different character who they never debuted. So in the meantime, my independent character, Famous B, was still utilized on the show, which is a credit to them. You know, I wasn't just sitting around, just kind of waiting kind of deal. I was still doing things. And I guess whenever they decided not to utilize the character, that's when you see the character Famous B and their creation start to emerge in season two with the 423 Get Fame.
Well, I was going to mention that, you know, in season two, you emerged basically as a talent agent, as a star maker. And that's when you started doing the mock ads with the 423 Get Fame number. Whose idea was that? I mean, when they pitched it to you, were you on board with it? Because you're a wrestler and all of a sudden you find out that you're not going to be wrestling as much. So what were your initial thoughts?
Right. Well, Chris DeJoseph, and I give him a lot of credit. Well, actually, I give him all the credit for this idea. He came to me at the end of season one. Chris DeJoseph is the head writer there in Lucha Underground. And he said, you know, I have this idea where you're pitching this number. And, you know, he was giving me the whole gist of the character. And, you know, it was one of those things where after, you know, he pitched the idea to me, I thought about it and I said, okay, this is great because it gives me the opportunity to display or show what else I can do. Because up until that point, a lot of, you know, my fans hadn't seen me in the light where I actually had a speaking role per se, because like you said before that, just, you know, I was, you know, doing a lot of matches and I was never featured in this light. So I thought that this would be a great opportunity to show how versatile I am in terms of not only can I wrestle, not only can I speak, not only can I manage, not only can I ring announce, not only can I commentate, this would give me the platform to do all these different things. And I think it's turned out incredible ever since.
How's it been for you to work on the show? Do they give you any creative freedom when it comes either to your character or any of the stories on the show? Or is it just, here's what we're doing and you just go out there and you do it?
No, it's very much a group, collective effort. I do have a lot of creative freedom, I should say, and just different aspects of the character, whether it be, hey, check this out, this is an idea I have, and then, you know, we all kind of converse and talk about it, and nine times out of ten I usually like what I'm able to bring to the table as Famous B, because at the end of the day I am Famous B, and you know, lucky for me, they created a character that's based off of me, so it's not like I don't feel like I have to be another character or play another role. What you're saying is just me amped up to the next level and being over the top, you know, sometimes silly, sometimes funny, sometimes goofy, but also sometimes very serious, as you've been able to see as well. So I get to take the character to a lot of different phases, and I think that touches on a lot of the viewers' emotions, and I think that's one of the things that makes me successful, is I have that leeway to kind of just kind of freestyle a little bit while I'm out there. And I think the freestyling does me good, because like I said, a lot of the things that has come with the character has been very organic, and I think a lot of people has enjoyed it.
Now, you've represented Masquerita Sagrada, Dr. Wagner Jr. I mean, what's that been like, working with someone like Dr. Wagner with the history that he's had in Mexico?
It's been nothing but incredible. It's been nothing but good times with the doctor. It's been awesome, and it's just one of those things where it's like we're such a good team, and it goes back to what I was saying about being versatile and just adapting to different stars such as Dr. Wagner, working with Mascarita Sagrada, who's a famous luchador in his own right, one of the most famous minis, you know, ever. And just adapting to and adjusting to their styles and making everything work and making everything fit and telling stories with it. And it's been nothing but fun. And, you know, it's been some wacky things have happened or come out of it, such as the Believer's Backlash match too. But it's been fun working with everybody on the show. Everybody is just so, you know, close as a cast, as a unit, as creative, and you know, we all have fun doing what we do, and we all love to do it. So it's been nothing but fantastic.
Well, since you brought it up, you know, one of my favorite moments from the show actually came during that Believer's Backlash match that you and Mascarita had when you pulled out the old Rick the Model Martel atomizer.
Yes.
It even had the word arrogance on it. I was very impressed. I popped huge when I saw that. Whose idea was that? Who came up with that?
Oh, man. It's largely the writers, and you know, they just convey what they would like to see with the art department. And you know, the art department, we have a very talented art department who puts together a lot of the props and gimmicks that you see on the show. And yeah, we have a very good crew that can put together things from the based off of the imagination of you know, the talent and the creative.
Well, you're just talking about the fact that you grew up in the 80s on that right. Version of WWF. You must have seen that and been like, oh, I can work with this. This is awesome.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's one of those things where it's a natural instinct to have grown up in that realm or that era, and pretty much have sticking with the business my entire life to, so therefore, you know, when I'm in a position or in a match like that, to go out there and just have the natural instincts and the natural reactions that I do, and performing a match like this, it just comes to me naturally. And it's fun to do it. And it's fun to sit back and watch. And, you know, having a match like that, you as a performer, you get, you know, you see things that you're like, okay, well, if I'm ever in a situation again, or the next time I have a match like this, I already know how I would adjust it and how, you know, I would, what changes I would make and things like that. And as fun as it is, it's like, okay, well, yeah, there's a lot more where that come from, because the wheels are already spinning.
I don't know where you go after having a bowling ball rolled into your balls. It doesn't get much harder than that.
Yeah, that was pretty nuts, I will say.
Very nice. Very nice play on words. I got to ask you this. If Famous B had his choice and could pick anybody in the wrestling business right now to help make them a star, because that's what Famous B does. He is a star
Correct.
Maker. If you could take
Correct.
Them on as your newest client, they could already be someone in Lucha Underground. You could mm-hmm. bring them from the outside into Lucha Underground from another company. Who would that person be?
Well, that's a very fantastic question. And it's very tough because there are a lot of potential talents. There are a lot of potential clients that Famous B would love to take to fame, to superstardom. But if I had to pick that one person that just has that it factor, that one person that we could just go all the way to the top, I would have to pick Tejano. I've been waiting to get that guy. I will do anything to get that guy. I will stop at nothing to get that guy. That guy is a real thoroughbred, and he's the one that is on my list right now. The one, the only. And that's what I'm putting all my marbles into. That's what I'm putting all my focus into. That's what I'm channeling all my energy into. And it's going to be hard to turn down fame and fortune.
Now, do you have a favorite match or a scene from Lucha Underground from these first three seasons that does not involve yourself?
It's very hard because there have been some terrific, fantastic matches on the show. It's hard to narrow it down to just like one, two, maybe even three. Oh, my goodness. You know, there was a three-way with the debut of Phoenix, Drago, and Pentagon Jr. During season one. Fantastic. Anything with Johnny Mundo in it. It's fantastic. I mean, there's just so many. It's hard to pinpoint. I mean, there was the Zeto Miedo match between Vampiro and Pentagon. There was Rey Mysterio versus Prince Puma. I mean, there's just so many. It's hard to narrow it down. I mean, you know, the talent that steps in that ring in that temple, man. You know, nobody takes any nights off. I mean, when we get in that ring, we're all business. And, man, we put together a great collection of matches between season one, two, and what you've seen on season three so far, and more to come.
Now, I know you can't give too much away. I wouldn't want you to spoil anything anyway. But what can people expect from the second half of season three? I know we've got an all-night-long match coming up with the Mac and Johnny Mundo, Rey Mysterio and Matanza. I know they have some unfinished business. Dario Cueto and Lorenzo Lamas are up to no good. There's so much going on the show. What can people expect when the show comes back this Wednesday?
Well, people can expect the same excitement, the same drama, the same, you know, fantastic matches that they have been seeing so far, and it's only going to get that much better. It's only going to get that much hotter. See, the things in the temple are heating up, and they're heating up on the road to Ultima Lucha 3. So just the journey, the experience headed into Ultima Lucha is something that you're definitely going to want to strap in and fasten your seatbelt for. And as I've said before, I have already announced that I have plans to launch my full-on talent agency. So you'll definitely see me going after the top talent that I see in my eyes. And this agency is going to be fantastic. You know, 423 Get Fame is a phenomenon.
Well, if you ever need a talent scout...
You're my man. Let me guess. The Solo Monster is my man.
I'm available. I'm just saying.
I love it. We could definitely do some work. Solo Monster, you know, you're all right with me. You're all right in my book. And we could definitely do some work together, my man.
Cool. We're going to have to talk about that off the air. Now, yes. Now, before we wrap up, let me ask you this. Have you heard anything about there being a season four? There was some chatter late last year about tapings happening in the fall. Which never materialized, and that always makes me very skittish. I mean, have they told you guys anything about that?
You know what? No, nothing has been announced yet, and I think the feeling is that we all have our fingers crossed, because once again, you know, we love taping Lucha. We love, you know, everything that we do, and you know, putting out the product that the fans enjoy so much that we can just see, and you know, just always. You know, the Lucha Click is always strong, and they let us know how much they appreciate the product. So we love performing and filming and taping and all the, you know, all that good stuff. So the feeling is that everybody has their fingers crossed, and we're pretty much waiting, you know, just like everybody else is, to, you know, hear the word or see what's going on or see what we're doing going forward. So, you know, fingers crossed, but we don't have any official word yet, but I'm pretty sure when or if they're ready to pull the trigger, we'll all know and find out together.
Well, I'm looking forward to the big return. It is this Wednesday at 8 Eastern on El Rey Network. And also, you can go back and watch those first few seasons of Lucha Underground on Netflix and iTunes as well, for people who want to get caught up on the show.
That's right. And also Amazon carries season 1, 2, and what you've seen from season 3. Amazon. Check it out on Amazon as well.
That's right. Absolutely. Now, you can follow Famous B on Twitter at FamousB23. Anything else you'd like to promote before I let you go? Maybe a certain phone number?
Well, absolutely. You know the number, 423-GET-FAME. Call now and be famous.
We can guarantee that you'll be able to get through the way that I did. I had a special extension that I dialed to get you on the phone here.
That's right. But you can still try. Check me out. Lucha El Rey, baby. Wednesdays.
See, I feel more famous already. Thank you, Famous B.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.
How cool was that? Got Famous B on the phone. I just wanted to call and leave a message like everybody else does. I didn't see that coming. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I'll try to run through as many of these as I can, but my voice, it's holding up okay. It sounds okay, but it's about to go. So let's get on with this here. Brian from New Brunswick, New Jersey. What do you think about FloSlam raising their monthly subscription rate from $20 to $30 a month without any warning? Yeah, you know what? I heard about that from Mike Johnson over at PW Insider. I find that hilarious that they think they could charge 20 bucks more per month than what WWE charges for its own network. That is comical to me. If you are looking for a surefire way to kill your business, that would be it. And to up their rates without even letting people know, to just, you know, one morning you wake up and you find out. Now, I don't know how that applies to existing customers. It's possible existing customers are grandfathered in and their rates are not going to be affected. But still, I mean, if you're a new subscriber, you're interested in joining, I mean, $30 a month, that's a lot of money. For what you're getting, I'm not really entirely sure that it's worth it. But to not even tell people, you could add poor customer service to the list. Ryan from Atlanta. Do you think they should put the UK Championship on SmackDown like they have the Cruiserweights on Raw? I think this could be a great idea instead of having another show to watch each week. Yeah, but then we don't get Jim Ross and Nigel McGuinness calling the match. Well, I guess they could bring them to SmackDown. I guess technically you could bring JR and Nigel to SmackDown to call one match a week. That seems like kind of a waste to me, though. I'd rather have them call in their own show, honestly. I've been saying I'm really looking forward to what the UK show looks like once it becomes a weekly thing. It's possible that, you know, I watch for 2 weeks and then tune out. Or it could be something that keeps my interest and it becomes one of my favorite shows. You know, I'm genuinely interested to see what the presentation looks like. Frankly, I would rather they kill 205 Live and replace it with the UK show. So that way you're replacing one show, you're not really adding a new one, but still tape the UK show someplace in the UK. Don't replace it with 205 Live and just do it the same way. Because that's a surefire way to kill the whole show. Don't tape it after Raw, don't tape it after SmackDown. Tape it in the UK from your small little venues. Because the 205 Live experiment has just been a failure so far, at least as far as the show. I mean, there's a lot of talented guys in the division. Neville is certainly a success story. Austin Aries is doing well. But in terms of the show itself, I think it's been a complete failure so far. Raymond, I believe this is Raymond the Mountie Medina from San Juan, Puerto Rico. I was listening on Friday to Edge and Christian's Pod of Awesomeness and their new Anatomy of a Match segment. Or I guess that was the whole episode, Anatomy of a Match, they called it. It sounds familiar, doesn't it? I guess they covered the 1996 Mind Games match between Shawn Michaels and Mankind from In Your House. But this whole Anatomy of a Match thing is something brand new that they started. People, like, I pointed it out, like, tongue-in-cheek, and people were like, oh, get a lawyer. And I'm like, it's fine. But it got me wondering, like, when did I do the first Match Anatomy segment on the show? It was a long time ago. And so I actually started keeping a log. I know I kind of tapered off. I haven't done a Match Anatomy segment where I pick apart a match in a long time, but I started keeping a log at the beginning when I was doing it. So I checked back, you know, and I wanted to make sure I had it handy here. I did the very first Match Anatomy. I debuted Match Anatomy as a segment on this show way back in 2011. So we're going back 6 years here. It's episode 191. I used the Goldberg versus Raven match for the U.S. title from WCW Monday Nitro in 1998. That was the very first Match Anatomy that I ever did. And maybe I did half a dozen more after that. But I did get a chuckle when I saw the new name of their segment. But anyway, Raymond wants to know, he thinks it's a very underrated match. What are my thoughts on the Shawn Michaels Mankind match from Mind Games? I've said on the podcast before, it's one of my favorite matches. I think it's one of Shawn Michaels' best matches. I think it's one of Mick Foley's. You could even argue that it is his best match. You know, some people might debate that and say, no, it was the street fight with Triple H, or it was the Hell in a Cell with The Undertaker. But if it's not number one, it's certainly in the top three of best matches I think he's ever had. And you say it's underrated. I'm not really sure who's underrating it, because everybody that I've ever talked to about this, or when I've seen countdowns of Shawn Michaels' best matches and Mick Foley's best matches, invariably, it's basically always on the list. So maybe it doesn't get a lot of love from WWE in terms of, I don't know, video packages and stuff. I'm not really sure what they could be doing with it, but I wouldn't say it's underrated at all. I think people have rated it just fine. I think most people would agree that it's one of the best matches of either of their careers. Maddie from Cincinnati. What do you make of the comments that Road Warrior Animal made recently in an interview on Hannibal TV, saying that the Dudley Boys are not a legendary tag team like the Road Warriors are? So I saw the clip. Before I got Maddie's question, I didn't even know about this. So I went on the Hannibal TV channel, which I would suggest everybody does, by the way. He does some great shoot interviews. They're all free. He'll cut them up into little clips sometimes, but you'll also find the full, these are like 2 hour long shoots in some cases. He goes to the person's house, and interviews them. There's some great stuff. There's actually one with Demolition. I hope it's still up there, that I watched a while back. So definitely check out, I think it's The Hannibal TV is the name of the channel. But anyway, I saw the clip of him talking about the Dudleys. It's about 3 minutes long, and I disagree. I disagree with Animal. But I do see where he's coming from, okay? When the Road Warriors were on top, the wrestling business was so much different than it is today. It's almost unfair to compare the two. You know, back then you had different territories. You can go from one place to the next. You weren't bound by a contract. You didn't have as much weekly television the way they do now, where they just water guys down. Like when the Dudleys left WWE in 2005, I think it was, those guys were so stale. They were as stale as a month-old loaf of bread. And the best thing I think that could have happened to them was for them to leave. Now, the way they left, it wasn't exactly an amicable split. But the best thing that could have happened to them, I think, was for them to leave and go to TNA. And they got many, many years in TNA. It kind of rejuvenated them in a way. Even LOD. Look at LOD when they came back in 1997 and had that next big run in WWF. Did they feel as special as the LOD from 5 or 10 years earlier? No, they didn't. And then, of course, the booking didn't help. Because they would, you know, back in the day, the Road Warriors wouldn't lose very often, right? They were this intimidating team that would come out and just kill jobbers and kill guys. So when they came back in 97, they were older. And they were matched up with other teams that they couldn't just bounce around the ring like they used to in the late 80s. And then they went on a losing streak and Hawk was a drunk. And then Hawk got pushed off the Titantron. It was embarrassing. It was very embarrassing. But that was the nature of wrestling in 97. Episodic television, right? I mean, it was just a different time. And I think if the Dudleys would have come up in the late 80s, you know what? Maybe they would have been the ones to win 15 titles in different promotions all over the world. And in different territories. I mean, as it is, it's not like they just won belts in this country. They did win the IWGP Tag Team belts in New Japan. So they did that. They won the WWE Tag Team titles, the ECW Tag Team titles, the TNA Tag Team titles. I don't count the WCW Tag Team titles because that's a joke. WCW was already dead by that point, so you could put that on the side. So Yeah, I mean, the Dudleys are not as traveled, maybe, as LOD was back in the day, but you know what the Dudleys did? I'll tell you what the Dudleys did and why they will go down as a legendary tag team. The Dudleys did a few things. They popularized the table match in WWE. Okay, all due respect to Public Enemy, they had a cup of coffee in WWE. They didn't do squat there. In WCW, they had a little bit more of a run, but, you know, it wasn't like this. They never quite matched the run they had in ECW. Paul Heyman was able to exploit those guys perfectly. They were a hot act in ECW, and they made tables famous and all that kind of stuff. But on, like, a national stage and, like, the big promotions, it was the Dudley Boys who did that. You know, Bubba and Devon were the ones who made that whole gimmick famous on a national stage. And then it was the Dudleys, and it was the Hardys, and it was Edge and Christian who turned out all of those TLC matches. Those became pretty legendary, I would say. Right? To this generation, the Dudley Boys would be considered legends. It's just a different time. If you transplanted the Road Warriors from 1987 into WWE today, talented as they were, they look, I'm not saying they would have, but they could very well have ended up in the role the Ascension is in. The Ascension come out there, oh, they look like tough guys. They got the face paint. They're like a, I mean, they're like a rent-a-cop version of LOD now. But if you had the actual LOD from back in the day, who's to say that they wouldn't just be in that spot? Mired in the mid-card. Ooh, now it's all about work rate and guys flying around the ring. You didn't see the LOD flying all over the place that much back in the day, right? And now, forget about it. You hand them a written promo they'd have to memorize instead of just letting them cut a promo on their own? You think that would end well? I mean, Hawk at least had the charisma to probably pull it off. Animal, I don't know. But, you know, it's just different. It's very, very different. They would have to conform to what WWE allows today. And if they go in there and they're stiff as all hell and they only have 5 moves, how's that going to get over with today's audience? Are they going to be receptive to that? You got the grind of weekly television. Those guys are not going to be protected the way they were back in the late 80s. It's just not going to happen. They would be exposed in 5 minutes. The Dudley Boys could brawl. They could talk. They had the coolest finish in the wrestling business, you know, the 3D. And they own that table gimmick. The table was more over, and I would argue still is, than 90% of the roster. So, yes, the Road Warriors were a legendary team. Nobody is debating that, right? There's a reason they call it the Road Warrior Pop. No one is denying their legendary status, but to tear down the Dudleys and say, well, the Dudleys aren't what we were, the Dudleys can't be what you are, because the Dudleys came along at a later time when things were so different. It's impossible almost to even compare the two. You have to look at it in the context of today. And in the context of today, the Dudley Boys are absolutely a Hall of Fame caliber legendary tag team. Now, if Animal's point is, well, if Bubba and Devon came along in my day, you know, they wouldn't have been so successful. You could argue that. It's impossible to prove. But yes, you could argue that. But that's not what he's saying, and I think he's flat out wrong. Jay Retro from Queens, New York. How valuable are wrestlers' autographs? When WrestleCon comes around, there's a big market for it, but $200 for a top name like Hogan or Sting just does not seem reasonable. On the other hand, I understand that for an old-timer or a struggling wrestler, an autograph is their one real commodity. My uncle was friends with Ox Baker before he died, and I remember he wouldn't even sign an old lady's cane unless he was paid. Please let me know your perspective on this matter. Autographs still mean something to some people. Me personally, I do value the autographs that I have. I collected a whole bunch when I was younger over the years. I have autographs from Vince McMahon and Bret Hart and Ric Flair, Owen Hart. I value that one. It depends also on what you get signed. Is it just a regular piece of paper? Did they sign something that has some sort of sentimental value to you? Did they sign a ticket stub, right? I had Ric Flair as an example, and this actually wasn't that long ago. This was several years ago, but it was at Caroline's. Flair was making an appearance at Caroline's on Broadway here in New York. And I went, and I brought with me the very first issue of WWF Magazine that I ever bought. I have all my magazines still. They're actually right behind me. They're coated in about 6 layers of dust. But the one thing I did keep, I kept all of my WWF magazines going back to 92. So the very first one I ever bought was from February of 92. It's the one with Flair sitting in the director's chair on the cover. And I had him sign that. I had him sign the cover. Now, that's a really cool memento to have. But I think my perspective is, unless it's a special kind of item like that or something you want to frame and put on a wall, I don't really care much about autographs anymore. Today, it's all about photos. Who can I get a photo with so I can post it on social media, right? Like, that's what everyone does these days. And I personally, I find more value in that than an autograph. Now, unless you're the kind of person who just wants to turn around and sell all the autographs and make money off it, then, you know, more power to you. And a lot of people do that. For me, it's all about photo, not autograph. I certainly would not pay $200 for anyone's autograph. I wouldn't pay half that for someone's autograph. But to get a picture taken with them, that lives forever, man. That's proof that you met whoever it is, and that thing just lives on forever. So I find more value in that. David from Westland, Michigan. I was watching an episode of Raw from June of 1997, where Bret Hart informed Shawn Michaels that his big dream match at King of the Ring was not going to happen now, thanks to an attack from Stone Cold Steve Austin the previous week. Was this part of just an ongoing storyline, or was there a match planned between Bret and Shawn that did not happen? Yes, there was. There was a match that was announced on television, in fact, that the two of them were going to have. Now, what happened was Bret had a knee injury. I think he might have had his knee scoped. So it wasn't like a major operation that he had, but he had his knee operated on. That was around the time he was in a wheelchair on TV every week. And they thought that he would be back in time, because it was only a scope, for a King of the Ring match against Shawn Michaels. And they started to promote it. And unfortunately, he turned out to not be ready. Now, how much of that was him not being ready? How much of that was the bickering between him and Shawn? Did Bret pull some sort of nonsense where he could have wrestled, but he didn't want to? Who knows? But I guess they claimed his knee wasn't ready. It was going to... Now, here's what the match was going to be. And maybe it's for the better that it didn't happen. Because you've got Bret with a bad knee. The match was only going to go 10 minutes. So it was going to have a 10-minute time limit. All of the members of the Hart Foundation were going to be handcuffed to the ring posts outside the ring. And the stipulation was that if Shawn lost, he could never again wrestle in the United States. Which is basically the exact same stipulation they used in August for SummerSlam, for the Bret Hart Undertaker match, when Shawn was the referee. That if Shawn somehow screwed Bret, or hit Bret, that Shawn could never again wrestle in the U.S. So they just took the stipulation that they couldn't use in June, and they applied it to the match in August. But because Bret couldn't go, they just scrapped the whole thing, and that's why we ended up getting Stone Cold Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels in a match at King of the Ring, even though they were the tag team champions. It didn't really make a lot of sense to put them against each other. But that was the backup plan. It was, you know, that's why not only did we get Shawn and Austin on that show, we got a Stone Cold Brian Pillman match. I think it might have been the only Stone Cold Brian Pillman match they ever did in WWF on Raw. Because I think originally that was going to take place at the pay-per-view, but they had to reshuffle things around a little bit. But yeah, that Shawn Steve Austin match is a classic. I mean, it's a really good match. That's the match where the special needs kid either fell or jumped over the barricade. He tried to go after, I think he tried to go after Austin. And Michaels, being the good guy that he was, went outside and was trying to protect the kid because the security guards were kind of roughing him up and trying to put him back over the barricade. And that was an interesting thing to see there at the beginning of that match with that kid trying to get into that ring. Antoine from Durham, North Carolina. Do you know if Rick Martel is on bad terms with WWE? I ask because I wondered why he hasn't been put in the Hall of Fame yet. That's a good question. I never heard about him bad-mouthing the company, and the company does not acknowledge him at all. I find this very sad because I loved his model character, and I thought that he was a very underrated worker. Do you think he will be inducted into the Hall of Fame one day? I sure hope so. I've advocated for him in the past, him and Demolition both, to go into the Hall of Fame. You know, the model character is what a lot of people remember, even though it was kind of a goofy character. But his work before then, I mean, he was AWA champion, right? I mean, he had a lot of success. He was an AWA champion. He was a tag team champion in WWF. And even had a little comeback in 93. Remember, he came back and it came down to him and Razor Ramon in that battle royal to crown a new Intercontinental champion. He had another life, another kind of second chance in WCW during the Monday Night Wars. This was around 97, so WCW at that point was number one. They were on top, and they brought in Rick Martel. So here's this guy from many, many years ago, but I tell you, he could still go. Martel had these great matches. I think it was with Booker T. I think they were wrestling over the WCW television title. I think he won the title. And then he suffered this catastrophic knee injury. I think he needed reconstructive surgery, but that was it. That I think that was the injury that ended his career. So who knows how much longer he could have gone on. But does Rick Martel belong in the Hall of Fame? Absolutely. Does he have heat with the company? I don't think so. I don't think there's any heat there at all. The last time I remember seeing Rick Martel, it wasn't that long ago. He was in the audience for a WWE pay-per-view within the last 10 years. And it might have been one of those Taboo Tuesday. I don't remember which pay-per-view it was. Somebody can help me out here. But he was sitting in the front row. And I don't remember if he got physical and did anything, but yeah, it's not like nobody's seen him or he hasn't had anything to do with them in like 20, 30 years. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that he was there. But Martel is one of these guys who, and I have a lot of respect for him, he just made a clean break from the business, right? He had the comeback with WCW, he got hurt, and at that point he decided, I'm done. And I don't know that he ever wrestled again after that. I think he got into real estate, he just kind of created this other career for himself. He made a clean break from wrestling, and he said, that's it. I had my run. I had my fun. I enjoyed it. I've heard him in shoot interviews before. He's very complimentary of people and very respectful. He doesn't bury people. So I have a lot of respect for Rick Martel, and I don't believe there's any heat there, and I think it's just he's not a priority to them. And when they need people, there's going to come a year where he'll be one of those inductions they throw out. They'll probably put him in there as the model too. But I do think he'll go in at some point. He deserves to. John from Medford, New York. What is your guilty pleasure on YouTube right now? I heard you mention watching random clips recently of The Sopranos. Be it wrestling or otherwise, what are you watching right now? Well, I've moved on from The Sopranos clips. I think I've watched them all. My new favorite thing on YouTube, actually, is this channel called, Brave Wilderness. Look that up. Brave, I think that's the name of the channel itself. Brave Wilderness. It's got this guy, Coyote Peterson is his name. He travels all over the world. He goes to these exotic locations, looking for all kinds of creatures and insects, and he interacts with them. And in some cases, he has them either sting him or bite him. To show people what happens and to show people why they're so dangerous. Like, he'll go to parts of the Costa Rican rainforest. And I remember when I went to Costa Rica, and this was already 6 or 7 years ago. Ironically, the last time I think I missed doing a podcast, the last time I missed a week, might have been when I went to Costa Rica. But I remember being in the rainforest, and I was so freaked out because I don't like any of that stuff, right? So they're telling me, oh, there's going to be tarantulas, and there's going to be, and I'm like, yeah, peace out. And I wanted to leave. And my friends were like, no, it'll be a lot of fun. And they were right. It turned out to be a blast. I loved it. I saw these exotic creatures. One of the guides who was with us, we weren't really on a tour. We kind of did our own thing, but we were part of a group. We went on one of these expeditions in the rainforest one night. And this was at night. And they were determined to find a tarantula's nest. And I'm like, I don't know if that's such a good idea. So they're like putting a stick into the hole, trying to taunt them to come out. Out comes this, I got this great photo. I can't even believe I got this close to this thing. But I got this great photo of this tarantula, and then it crawled back into the hole. It's, if you ever have a chance to do anything like that, I would suggest doing it. So I've been watching a lot of this guy's videos, and I watched him. Some of the stuff he does is just ridiculous. I mean, he's out of his freaking mind. I watched one that he did called the Bee Beard, where he got stung by 3,000 bees all at once. His lips swelled within minutes. His lips swelled up so much. He looked like one of those Real Housewives. There's another video where he gets stung by a bullet ant, which supposedly the bullet ant, they have some kind of pain scale. It is the most painful insect sting in the animal kingdom. So he got stung by that. He got stung by a scorpion. He got bitten by a crocodile. Like, all this crazy stuff. So if that's your thing, look it up, because I've been addicted to his videos lately. It's called Brave Wilderness. And we'll do one more here. Andrew in Arkansas. Who do you have in the NBA Finals, the Cavs or the Warriors? Well, I mean, how can you bet against LeBron James, right? So I have to go with the Cavs. Now, I know I'm not a big NBA fan, but I follow things when we get down to the finals and stuff, and I know enough about it to see all these betting odds lately. The betting odds apparently have Golden State up by more than any team in history. I think they're favored to win here in the finals. But I'm going to go against the odds. It's hard for me to sit here and think of LeBron James as an underdog, but I guess his team would be the underdog going into this series. I'm going to go with the underdogs here. And I'm going to pick Cleveland in 7, just like they did last year. They won in 7 last year. I think they'll do the same this year. So I somehow managed to make it to the end here without completely losing my voice, even though my throat is on fire right now. But thank you for bearing with me here. I woke up this morning and I was like, oh boy, how am I going to do this? But we did it. If you have questions, you keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. Don't forget, Lucha Underground is back this Wednesday, 8 Eastern on El Rey Network. That also means the return of the Lucha Underground reviews here on the podcast. So that'll be starting next week with episode 498 here on our road to 500. Keep supporting the show either by PayPal, use our Audible link, buy a shirt in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. There's a lot of different ways to show your support for this podcast. I very much appreciate each and every one of you. Have yourselves a fantastic rest of your Memorial Day weekend. And those of you who have a day off from work on Monday, which I would imagine is most of you, enjoy it. I don't think we get nearly enough of those. And I will be back with a brand new podcast next weekend. We'll have Extreme Rules predictions and all the latest stuff from the wacky world of wrestling. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week as we enter the month of June, and I will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. As always, until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solemonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.